This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Lots happening from Beacon Hill to Capitol Hill today. COVID cases on the rise in Massachusetts. President Biden's bipartisan infrastructure bill is caught up in a political minefield. So we are checking in with a member of our delegation about how Congress and our elected officials there should respond to both and some other things. Congressman Jake Auchincloss, who represents Massachusetts' 4th Congressional District, joins us from Washington, D.C. He is in the House cloakroom now. Representative Auchincloss, thanks for stepping aside and talking to us here on Radio Boston.
Always a pleasure to be with you.
So I had a full agenda, but news is going to news. So I'm going to add a new one right to the top, which is this afternoon, a lot of controversy over the fact that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has essentially pulled two of Kevin McCarthy's picks for the January 6th investigative committee, and that the Kevin McCarthy is angry. This looks like it's going to cause another blow up. What are you hearing and what are your reactions?
The purpose of this select committee is to provide an objective accounting for the American public today and for posterity about what happened on January 6th and how we prevent it from happening again. It's a matter of democratic integrity. The speaker reached out her hand to Republicans and said, let's make this bipartisan, just like we did after 9/11, for the good of the country. And the Republicans chose Trump over truth. And now they're having a tantrum because the speaker is insisting that this actually be an objective committee. They're trying to tank it, and she's trying to make sure that it actually serves its intended purpose. So I have no sympathy for what we're hearing from Leader McCarthy.
What's the path forward now?
The path forward is that the speaker is going to put people on the committee that she has confidence in and the American people can have confidence in, are truly coming to this in a spirit of curiosity, trying to seek the facts and trying to put together an objective reckoning for the public and for posterity that can really help heal our democracy. That's what the American people deserve right now. We saw a traumatizing attack on our very core institutions, and people want to see, how can we prevent this from happening again? And what are the root causes that led to this? She is going to deliver that through the select committee. And we're just not going to allow Trump through his cronies in Congress to undermine it.
So, you know, we talked to you shortly after January 6th. You are a former Marine. This has got to be personal for everyone. Talk us through how this turns out to be an objective investigation and how everybody keeps eyes clear and clean as this plays out.
I think it's personal for every American, not just for members of Congress who were in the chamber that day. And that level of emotional resonance to me is not a bad thing. It does not mean that we cannot be objective. It simply means that the urgency of getting the truth is increased, that we feel a deep obligation to have a true reckoning about what happened that day. So I don't think a high emotional register detracts from quality investigation. I mean, certainly after 9/11, Americans across the political spectrum felt incredibly invested in what had happened, but we were still able to deliver what has become, I think, a almost universally renowned report on that event. And we can do the same thing after January 6th.
All right. I want to move on to the pandemic here. Cases are on the rise, including breakthrough cases in fully vaccinated people. According to the state's Department of Public Health, as of July 17th, more than 5,000 breakthrough cases, with 80 of them being fatal. I do also want to note that fatalities in that group make up 0.0018% of the vaccinated population here, but each loss is tragic and people are spooked by this climbing cases. Are you concerned right now with the trend we're seeing?
Yes, because scientists and public health experts have been clear that we should be concerned, and the data is supporting that. Now, I'm glad that you made that point about breakthrough COVID, because although it is absolutely a reality, we should also note that it does not mean that people should not get the vaccine because they're worried that, oh, well, you still get COVID. No, the vaccine absolutely is an incredibly effective means to not get COVID. And also it means that if you do get COVID, you are drastically less likely to be hospitalized or and certainly to die from it. So definitely still get the vaccine. But I'm feeling very frustrated, to be to be candid with you, because the vaccines are in abundance now in this country. And at a time when other countries throughout the world are struggling to get enough supply, and I'll talk about that later, we're having to give pickup trucks to people to convince them to get a shot that is truly a miracle of science. So I just want to say again, get the vaccine. Do it for your own safety. Do it for the ones that you love. Because if not, not only are you putting yourself and others that you love in jeopardy, we're at risk of backsliding after so much loss and so much work.
So the pickup truck reference, of course, being the various kinds of prizes and lotteries around the country that are being offered to try to encourage people. I want to stay on this for a second. More than 4.3 million people fully vaccinated in the Commonwealth. That's about 61%. But portions of the states are holdouts. In your district, as of July 15th, 47% of residents in Fall River, in Taunton, 51%, Attleboro, 54%. I've heard just now your message to them. What are you hearing from constituents who do not or are not getting vaccinated?
So I'm proud to say that Fall River now, based on my last conversation with the mayor a few days ago, has tipped above 50% vaccination rate, and that he is doing a tremendous amount of work to continue to raise that up. There's now increasingly good research about the right way to message to a vaccine hesitant population. It seems like it's decreasingly effective to talk about peer pressure or social norming, and more effective to reiterate the safety of the vaccine. And that message is most effective when it comes from Republican elected officials to Republican constituents. That people who are vaccine hesitant, who are supporters of Donald Trump, want to hear from Republican elected officials that the vaccine is safe. That's what the evidence is saying is the most effective messaging. And I'm not political about it. I just want people to get vaccines. So whatever works, we should be doing, which is why I'm so incredibly frustrated with my colleagues in Congress from the Republican Party who are unwilling to tell their constituents who would listen to them that this vaccine is safe and they need to get it. That is a moral responsibility. That is a patriotic responsibility that these Republicans have, and they're abdicating it.
Any conversations in the back rooms trying to sway Republican colleagues to carry a different message? And is the prevalence of the Delta variant starting to change people's minds?
After what we've seen over the last 18 months of this virus, after the willingness that we've seen from Trump and his enablers to politicize even the most basic science and public health, I have limited confidence, but I'm certainly going to continue to keep trying.
Okay, let's stay up on the Hill. I want to talk about infrastructure for a minute. Democrat leadership in the Senate wanted to start debate today on a bipartisan infrastructure bill. Republicans, however, are saying they don't want to start debate without further negotiations on the details. I mean, the details haven't really been hammered fully out yet. It kind of looks like this is turning into a standoff on how to proceed. But before today, it seemed like the bipartisan effort was moving. Are we in trouble here?
We're in the middle of negotiations. And as you well know, as I'm sure our listeners can appreciate, in politics, whenever you're in the middle of negotiations, it always kind of feels a little bit murky. I just want to pierce through the day in, day out politics, though, and just again express what we're actually trying to do. What we're trying to do is fix roads and bridges. We're trying to expand transit. We're trying to ensure clean water. And we're trying to expand high-speed internet access. And these four pillars are bipartisan everywhere except Washington, D.C. Democrat and Republican state and local elected officials in Massachusetts see and feel the need from Fall River to Brookline. This is tremendously popular legislation. We are going to get it done, but we got to stick the dismount, and we're currently still doing the twists and turns in the middle of the air.
So I think this is confusing for most people, Congressman, because we have the narrower bipartisan bill that's being hammered out on some what one might call more traditional infrastructure items. And then we have a $3.5 trillion spending package that Democrats have committed to putting through. It seems the main battle line is between putting both through or not getting the bipartisan, narrower roads and bridges kind of bill through. Is that linking the core of the problem? And is it sort of, you know, at all costs? Are you willing to give up a bipartisan bill that is bipartisan, if smaller, in order to get the bigger thing done?
At the end of the day, we're going to advance the Biden agenda, whether it's on strictly partisan lines or whether it's with bipartisan votes. We are going to pass something. We're going to ensure that the president and that congressional Democrats are able to keep our campaign promises to the American people, which was about rebuilding an economy that's working for everybody. So we're going to get it done. Let me just try to maybe speak to why the bipartisan effort is worth pursuing right now. And that is, it comes down to policy. With reconciliation, with the maneuver that you have to do if you only have Democratic votes, you can't do as much policy change as you want to do because of the rules of the House and the Senate reconciliation process. You can only do funding changes. You can't do policy changes. That does cut into what this infrastructure bill can accomplish, because we made significant policy changes in our infrastructure funding in the House version. We changed how we think about mobility away from car-centric highways to connecting people to jobs and services through all kinds of modalities, from trains to walking and cycling. And it would be disappointing to lose that opportunity to really change policy to make it more climate resilient and to make it more conducive to a more fair economy.
All right. So before we let you go, I do want to shift gears and I want to ask you about H.R. 3, which aims to further regulate the price of prescription drugs. You're a co-sponsor of the bill, but you also co-authored a letter to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi objecting to a clause in the bill. So that's kind of a dual position. Can you explain it?
As you said, I'm a co-sponsor of the bill and have 100% voting record with the Democratic caucus. So I am going and I'm working with the Speaker's office to ensure that Democrats pass drug pricing legislation. I also think that we can and should be lowering out-of-pocket costs for patients. That is a really critical feature of lowering prescription drug prices, is lowering it for Medicare and what the government pays, yes, but making sure we pass through those savings to what people actually pay at the countertop. And so I have been advocating for a hard cap on insulin drug prices per month and a hard cap on all out-of-pocket costs per month, so that our senior citizens and indeed all Americans are not put underwater by prescription drug costs.
So you have said that your objection is to HR3's clause capping prescription prices subject to federal negotiation at 120% of the average price in some other countries. And it seems your argument is about innovation and ensuring that, you know, there are new R&D investments. I know you're aware that the Huffington Post has argued that this is reflective of a position of the pharmaceutical industry and reported on you receiving both super PAC donations to a super PAC that supported you and donations to your campaign from pharma. What's your response there?
Well, I've been a supporter of Medicare negotiations since before I was even elected to Congress. So I'm a strong supporter of Medicare's ability to negotiate drug prices. We need to ensure that we are lowering out-of-pocket costs for patients, and that will eat into corporate profits. And the kind of blowback that you've seen against me, I think, is a reflection of what happens when you push back against putting profits over patients.
So what's the objection?
The objection is that we need to bring all parties to the table here. We need to bring the health insurers and the PBMs and make sure that they are actually lowering out-of-pocket costs for patients, as well as lowering list prices for the government.
And you're worried about innovation being suppressed if we shoot too far?
I think any drug pricing policy needs to account for out-of-pocket costs for patients. It needs to account for delivering cures for diseases like Alzheimer's and diabetes and cancer. And it needs to account for the important jobs that the life sciences sector creates, Massachusetts first and foremost. So it's a three-legged stool here. Number one is that people's monthly out-of-pocket costs are capped so that they can afford the drugs that they need for their treatments.
Okay, so I do want to come back to this, and I'm just going to push on this part one more time, because there were some large donations to the Super PAC, including one from Dr. Lori Glimcher, who is your mother, who sits on the board of directors of GlaxoSmithKline. It's not unusual to get pushback about concerns about campaign contributions and how they affect a legislator's choices on the floor. What are you doing to reassure constituents that you have a firewall between your donations and the positions that you're taking?
Well, I've got broad-based support across Massachusetts, across the host of professions, because people see that I am reflecting their values and advancing their priorities. My voting record is speaking for itself here. I think going to bat for patients out of pocket costs, going to bat for delivering cures is something very in line with what my voters want to see.
All right. Congressman Jake Auchincloss, who represents Massachusetts' 4th Congressional District. Really appreciate you taking the time. Thanks.
It's always good to be with you.